This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell.
Yesterday, the BC Supreme Court ruled against Premier John Horgan and the NDP government, who, with the enthusiastic support of the Green Party, sought to restrict the amount of bitumen flowing through BC, which was part of the strategy to stall, delay, ultimately get the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion killed, which the court acknowledged. The BC government declaration to use every tool in the box to derail the pipeline was what prompted, if you remember this, then Alberta Premier Rachel Notley to retaliate by putting a ban on the sale of BC wine in Alberta. They backed off when the NDP in BC filed the lawsuit, both parties saying they'd let the court decide. Well, they have. The BC Supreme Court, 5-member panel, voted unanimously that the BC NDP Green government acted unconstitutionally, as anyone, and I mean, I think anyone who follows the issue knows, the federal government has jurisdiction over interprovincial pipelines. I think the chance of a court changing that in favor of the province was oh so slim, if not none. Sure, they had people in the Green government or the NDP Green government who were hoping, but if they had to bet their own money, I can't believe that anyone in the BC Green government actually would have thought the court would take the jurisdiction away from the federal government. What's also noteworthy is the court's decision is that the justice has made clear that the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion is in the national interest and is governed by the National Energy Board, which the court noted had already imposed numerous conditions on the project. The court case was just an expensive way for the BC NDP to appease their coalition partners in the BC Green Party, along with Canadian and American environmental groups who, not surprisingly, are not happy with the ruling. For them, there's only one acceptable outcome. As U.S.-based corporate ethics in San Francisco made clear when they were the ones who launched the campaign in 2008 to landlock Alberta oil, the goal was no pipelines, nowhere, no matter what. Just recently, National Green Party leader Elizabeth May said, "We do not support a single additional barrel of output." The BC government has not disclosed how much money was spent, by the way, pursuing this, what can only be described, I think, as a politically motivated legal maneuver. Well, actually, that's not true, given that virtually no one's surprised by the ruling and that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, were spent by BC taxpayers. I got a sense that it could be described a whole bunch of other ways that I can't use on the radio. As an aside, though, I'm finding myself, it doesn't matter what issue it is with government, but I'm getting increasingly outraged by government wasting money because so many other important areas are going wanting. I mean, in my own case, I make it clear, I focus a lot of time trying to raise money for Special Olympics on behalf of children and adults with intellectual disabilities, especially for programs like Healthy Athlete. You know, most people assume that people with Down syndrome or Fragile X, microcephaly, I pronounced that incorrectly, other intellectual disabilities get the same level of health care as the rest of us in the public. Unfortunately, they're mistaken. So I don't think you're going to be surprised that I found myself shaking my head when I heard the BC government announce they're going to appeal the unanimous decision, spend more tax dollars, and there's no reason to suspect that they're going to be successful. This ruling isn't going to get overturned. Interprovincial pipelines fall under federal jurisdiction, and that's not going to change. I think that it's a safe bet that if the leaders of the BC NDP government or the Green Party were spending their own money, there wouldn't be an appeal. But what makes it even more ludicrous, I mean, think about this. The BC NDP government's prepared to go to court if Alberta follows through on its threat, in quotes, to turn off the taps, stop the oil, the gas, the diesel from flowing through the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So on the one hand, they're going to prepare to go to, they've gone to court to prevent oil from being shipped from Alberta, while at the same time, they promise to go to court if Alberta dares stop shipping oil through the same pipeline. What's also a head shaker is that while I don't see Alberta stopping the flow through Kinder Morgan, I could see them changing the mix of what's coming down that pipeline. They could simply send more crude and less refined products like gasoline, which would immediately push the price of gas in Vancouver's lower mainland and Vancouver Island significantly higher, which you think would be welcomed by the BC NDP and Green Party, given they want to push gas prices higher. That's what the carbon tax is all about. They're trying to discourage driving. I mean, come on, if Alberta were to replace gasoline with crude oil down the pipeline, I mean, the BC government's wishes would come true. $2 a liter is going to get a heck of a lot of people to reduce their driving. As I said, it's a head shaker. But come on, I mean, if the clock is actually winding down on taking action on climate change in order to avoid catastrophe, then why aren't the Green Party, along with the Suzuki Foundation, Greenpeace, public sector unions, and every other climate change advocate, alarmist, begging Alberta's Premier Kenny to turn off the taps. I'll take a break. I'll come back. Michael Levy's with me. I've also got Greg Weldon. Really looking forward to this. One of my favorite analysts, because he's the analyst that other analysts wait to hear what he's got to say because research is so thorough. So many other things. Ozzie Jurek, Victor Adair, Goofy Award, shocking stats. I'm glad you're with us right here on the Money Talks Network. Michael Levy joins me right now. Hey, Mike, I got a couple of stories in my mind that I wanted to hit at you there. I saw that the Royal Bank and the TD Bank had topped expectations with their earnings this past week in this quarter. But here's the thing. I mean, we know the Canadian economy slowed. There's other things going on. And I'm just wondering, we'll wait to get the other banks next week, but what's the deal there? How did they make that? They beat expectations.
Yeah, and Mike, nobody expected them to beat expectations. The analysts were all going to say the banks were probably going to flatline this quarter, maybe a little below expectations. But in fact, I've got to tell you that they're coming close to being what was forecast. But Mike, CIBC came in and they were first, and they didn't make forecasts. So you start to dig a little bit, and you find out that CIBC, which we probably already knew, does the giant part of their business within Canada, domestic banking, where then TD and Royal come out the next day. They beat expectations, and they did well in Canada, but their Canadian business was flat. But where they really did well is their foreign operations, and particularly south of the border. I mean, you can walk down the streets of Manhattan and you're going to see TD Bank branches like you do here in the Lower Mainland or in Alberta or the rest of Canada. The same thing with RBC. They have their business in Canada. They do a good business in Canada, but again, their domestic banking, their mortgage business, I mean, what's going on with mortgages has really taken a bite out of the Canadian banks, and they made it, but they made it on their wealth management and they made it on their foreign banking, viz. Banking in the U.S. And look, with Scotiabank and BMO to come, both of them have very, very significant holdings outside of Canada, particularly Scotiabank. They are not just in the U.S., but they have through the Caribbean and into other parts of the world. So they will do better because they have that diversified exposure.
Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense. We know that we've, as you just said, we've had that slowdown in mortgages. I mean, that's getting reported, it feels like, every week, you know, and that's banks' business. But interesting that they, the ones that have gone outside of the country, and I think it's to a bigger extent than most Canadians appreciate, you know, are the ones that are sort of doing well. That's paying off. Hey, but I've got to also go to something else here, because I think of you every... this is not... I mean, anytime I hear about Amazon, Mike, I think about you. And every time I hear about Tesla, I think about you. But what a week for Tesla. I mean, my goodness gracious. I mean, is the bloom finally off that stock?
Well, it is. I mean, talk about being off. Mike, there's just, you know, like a few quick numbers here. I hate inundating with numbers one after the other, but the all-time high in Tesla stock was $385. That's 102% above where it is now. The 52-week high in Tesla stock is about $380. That's 99% above the current share price. And the low in the stock is $190.63, 52-week low. Mike, I've got to tell you that Tesla has shed $30 billion in market cap this past year, and it risks running out of cash by year end unless they can pump up and sell enough cars and gain enough profit to keep them going. Otherwise, they're going to have to go back to the marketplace like they just did. And by the way, just as a side note, the bonds, convertible bonds that Tesla just issued today, are yielding 9.1% if you went into the marketplace to buy them, which means that they would have to really pay through the nose in order to float another bond issue if the acceptance of investors is at the level that it is right now.
Now, just I want you to go back on those numbers just for a sec. Give me the all-time high and what it's, you know, bottom line, where it's trading the last week.
Okay, so we're at $385 is the all-time high, and it closed at $190.63 on Friday, Mike. So it's just a huge move.
But there's one more, though. I've got to ask you about Morgan Stanley. Because they were the ones blowing the whistle on them this week. I mean, they put out a worst-case scenario that people are still probably falling off the floor with.
Well, they are, Mike. And you've got to know that it is exaggerated, because if what they're saying, if that were to come to place, Tesla would either be taken over by one of the bigger companies and just melded into a Ford or a you know, GM or some offshore auto company. But Mike, $10 a share for Tesla. Yeah. That's what Morgan Stanley said. Worst case scenario. There was another house that came out and said that it's code red at Tesla. Another one said $35 a share. So we may not have to take those exact prices to heart, but you've got to know where the sentiment lies, and that means investors are going to keep backing off, Mike.
Well, the sharks are swimming in the water because they are definitely smelling blood when you get this relentless stream of news that they've had. Good stuff, Mike. I want you to go out, and I know it's a special day for you this weekend, this Saturday. Have a wonderful time.
Thank you very much, Mike. Have a good weekend.
All the best. All the best, Mike. I'll take a break. I'll come back. By the way, Greg Weldon's joining me. I've got a quote of the week. So much coming your way right here on the Money Talks Network. You're listening to Money Talks. My name is Michael Campbell. You know, lots of interesting aspects about doing this job, the amount of feedback I get. But I'm going to share one example because it's in response to some comments I got this past week. I appreciate that I do talk about Special Olympics helping children and adults with intellectual disabilities and their family. Well, I just want to respond to a couple things by sharing a note from the father of one of our athletes, George McLaughlin, which I think will give you an idea why I think it's important. In quotes, "When you become a parent, all you want for your child is an opportunity. An opportunity to be whoever they want to be. You want your child to be able to play, to experience the power of sports. But when you learn that your child is different and is not able to compete, to play the same as other children, it hurts. It hurts deeply. Dreams are gone. Fear takes over. You try to find something to support your child, to find them, to share with them your passions, but always fear is there. So they age out of youth sports, and you don't know what's next. But when you find Special Olympics, you find a family. You find a family of athletes, volunteers, supporters who want the very best for your child as well. People who see beyond the disability and see the ability. People who help you see more than you're able to see yourself. People who are willing to understand your child and who understand your fears. People who understand that success starts with the first step, not the last. That success is built on having the opportunity to participate, the opportunity to play. Special Olympics has changed my life and the life of my family." Well, I think that does a wonderful job of laying it out, and it's a story I hear regularly. That's why I think it's important. I know in my own case, I've been lucky in life. I've got three able-bodied children, relatively good health myself and my wife, big support from my mom growing up, who was on her own, trying the best to make ends meet. Simply put, though, I think it's important to help others who may not have been as an easier road. Maybe not as fortunate in those ways. They have greater challenges to deal with. And if I can make that a little easier, I think it's the best money I can spend. Of course, I'd be asking for help with Special Olympics every year. I mean, come on, there's so much left to do. It'd be incredible. But it's even more pressing this year. It's sort of a lesson about business, because there's been some mergers and acquisitions of some of our major sponsors, and they're off to the States, not going to be no longer in Canada. So not surprising, they're going to focus their charitable giving there. Well, we need to fill that hole. I just want to say also, very positively, I want to acknowledge the people who I work with who obviously agree this is important. People like Rob Levy and Michael, Victor, Ozzy, Grant, who organizes our Outlook conference, our analysts like Eamon Piercy or Andrew Rulin, Joseph Schachter, Tyler Bullhorn, all stepped up, Jeff Olin, Paul Gill, Daniel Park, Ryan Irvine. I really do thank them. And there's others I'm going to mention as I go along. But it's really nice to see good people doing good things. Others giving auction items for the golf tournament. And believe me, I'm going to tell you more about that in the next couple of weeks, so save the email. Let me just give you one example, though, because I'm excited about it. I just heard all about it this past week. And I think I'm putting it down in the thrill of a lifetime category. Jeremy Levitt is the president of CMH Heliskiing and Summer Adventures. And I think adventures, by the way, is the right word for what those guys do. It is the kind of thing you remember for a lifetime, but they've put this incredible package together for our auction. It's a 3-day of heli hiking this summer for two people. It includes everything, but meals, guides, accommodation at the CMH Caribou Lodge. I mean, it's incredible. I know someone who's done this, by the way, and they said, you actually have no idea what it's literally like to stand on top of a mountain. Breathtaking, doesn't even get into the picture, doesn't begin to describe it. But my point is it's people like Jeremy Levitt and his company, CMH Heliskiing and Summer Adventures, that are making this kind of a difference, and many other people stepping up to say, let me help. That's all I was saying there. I mean, as I say, I find it heartening that people will take that time. I mean, we've had other auction donors, you know, Emblematica Brands, Anisimov Fine Art, Good Boy Prints, Interior Solutions, Haberdasher & Company, Me Style, Morgan Silver Report. There's just lots, and I'll get to more of them later. But it's incredible they make a difference. All I'm saying is that, yeah, we still need help. I'm chairman of the golf tournament that comes at the Northview Golf Course in Surrey on June 20th. And we still need individuals and businesses to step up. We've got room for more teams. And by the way, I'm very happy again to report a couple of our people jumping up and saying, hey, let me play. Craig Burrows, you know him from TriView. Howard Fitch from Capital Event Management. Both say, okay, I'll put in a team. We need people to play in the scramble format. We also have a best ball format. But we need teams. We need individuals and businesses to sponsor holes. I mean, 100% of it goes to the athletes and their families. You know, $1,000 for a hole, that's $500 after tax. I'll give you just the last word. I won't keep going on and on. Last word, though. Imagine if it was your son or daughter, grandchild, niece or nephew. Wouldn't you want someone to step up and help and say we care? Well, I sure would. As I say, it's a special opportunity. Just drop us a note at info@moneytalks.net. Put Special Olympics in the headline there. And if you can help, I can't tell you how much it'll be appreciated and how valuable it will be. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes. I got a quote of the week. I've got Aussie Jerk. We're going to make you some money, though, with Greg Weldon. That's one of the things we've done spectacularly well on Money Talks, all of our main themes. We're going to talk to Greg about that when we come back. Plus, of course, I've got a shocking stat for you. You don't want to miss out on that. And I think my Goofy's a very important one this week. So all of that's coming your way with Victor and Aussie right here on the Money Talks Network. Time now for this week's quote of the week. One of the biggest pieces of nonsense that's being peddled out there is that there's some sort of 97% consensus on climate change because they don't give the specifics. What's the consensus on? I mean, that is so much intellectual laziness in that statement to criticize. But instead, I'm just going to go to one of the biggest disputes among those that place climate change at the top of their list of concerns. And that is the debate over the role and potential of renewable energy in eliminating CO2 emissions and answering all of our energy needs, which brings me to this quote of the week by James Hansen. Now, this is Al Gore's climate advisor and the scientist who literally started the global warming worry in 1988. Not easy to dismiss what he's got to say, given he would be considered one of the leading advocates for taking action on climate change. He is in that group, though, of climate activists that say that renewables absolutely can't get the job done. He states in quotes, "Suggesting that renewables will let us phase rapidly off of fossil fuels in the United States, China, India, or the world as a whole is almost the equivalent of believing in the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy." So think about that, because that's what we're getting peddled in a lot of groups. At least acknowledge that there is a huge dispute going on right now within the climate activist community. Very pleased to welcome back to the show Greg Weldon with me. You can find him at WWW Weldon Online. Greg, always appreciate you finding time for us on the weekend.
My pleasure, Michael. And what, you don't believe in the Easter Bunny?
There you go. I'm in trouble now. Hey, I wanted to ask you, there's lots to talk about here. And starting with this, I think Sunday night sort of ends the European Union elections, you know, for the EU Parliament. You know, it's a four-day kind of affair. And this is just more of the uncertainty that's entered. You know, of course, we had Theresa May saying that she is going to resign on June 7th. All of this kind of backdrop for what's going on in the markets. How do you factor that in when you're looking at various investment areas?
Well, you know, that's kind of why I asked you, don't you believe in the Easter Bunny? Because really, that kind of sets the stage for the backdrop, which is global central banks must believe in the Easter Bunny, because how the heck else are they going to get out of the mess that is coming down the pipeline? And it's not you know, oh, is it going to be caused by this or is it going to be caused by that? Is it China? Is it trade? Is it, you know, we can look at all the landmines that are active right now out there, and ultimately we're going to step on one of them. And the problem is that when that happens, central banks, and particularly in Europe, are in a position where they're paralyzed, Mike. I mean, to think that the ECB, let alone places like the Riksbank in Sweden or the Swiss National Bank, of course, in Switzerland, they have the deepest negative official policy rates on the planet. They are bounded by the laws of physics at some point here where you can't keep taking rates deeper and deeper into negative territory on an official basis. You already have the 10-year Danish, the 10-year Swedish, the 10-year German. I mean, 10-year bond yields. I mean, people are paying away money to let governments hold their money for 10 years. So this level of insanity, when it comes to pass, whether it's Brexit, whether it's Turkey backfiring with non-performing loans into the Spanish banking system, which I think is probably one of the biggest risk factors kind of out there right now, I don't see how there's an easy way to paper over the next wave of deflation. And frankly, Mike, that wave is coming right at us. It's not a tsunami yet, but it's not insignificant either. And for central banks to think they're going to just hop on their normal surfboards and ride this wave, I think is really kind of short-sighted. And I think that, you know, it really kind of falls into the lap of the U.S. Federal Reserve. And we can certainly get into that at length.
Well, I'm so glad you've brought all of those factors up, because I think this is a really dominant theme that we're not hearing enough of in North America. Yeah, we're certainly hearing about China-U.S. trade dispute. Yes, that's in the news. Other things, the political machinations around President Trump. In Canada, we have our own set of sort of drama going on. And yet I sort of think this is the elephant in the room, as you just alluded to so beautifully.
Well, you know, again, well, I'll tell you, Mike, I mean, I just don't even think it matters that much when you start talking trade. It only matters if it doesn't work out. Okay, so then it really matters a lot. But a trade deal between the U.S. and China, I think people tend to overestimate what kind of a boon this might be, because it's not stimulus. This is not a tax cut. It's not fiscal stimulus. It's not QE. What it is leveling a playing field on a trade deficit for the U.S. annually, which is less than 2% of GDP. So it's not, even if you get a trade deal, all right, it's not a bad thing, and there'll be a psychological reaction for sure. But it is not an engine of global growth, and that is what you're lacking right now. You know, it's not good enough to just stay where you are. Given the amount of debt that's out there, consumers, corporations, governments, it's at record highs everywhere you turn. To think that you are going to not have an issue if you have flatlined, you know, GDP growth, and in Europe, you know, GDP growth is already below the rate of inflation. So you have negative real GDP growth. You know, so I think that the trade issue is shorter term and longer term, okay, because shorter term it's an issue, and when you get over it, it's a long-term dynamic. I'm going to throw you a curveball, Mike. I think there's some level of thought process to be had here where we ask ourselves, did China walk away from the table in a premeditated way? Did they kind of almost set this up, right, where they have this gigantic disappointment? Why? Because they can work the renminbi lower, and no one's really screaming bloody murder right now. All right, you have the deepest 52-week depreciation in the Chinese currency right now than you've had in almost three decades. And the last time you had this level, and it was a lot greater then, because you had the, you know, 100% plus devaluation of the Chinese renminbi in 1992. So to me, it's like, okay, if they can, in a stealth way, without the U.S. screaming bloody murder and currency manipulators, because now it's the market reaction to a failed trade deal that drives the renminbi sharply lower. And if you get to, say, 7.25, you know, renminbi dollar, then all of a sudden China walks back to the trade table, and all of a sudden they negotiate and you have a big deal, and you get a deal. But the problem is, Mike, that, again, is not an engine of global growth. You see it in the markets. And I will point out one of the problems is, again, this is kind of all veiled by this trade dynamic, which gives great cover for the fact the dollar is breaking out. The dollar is against many currencies, you know, at new highs, all right, or up double digits year over year. And this, in turn, is depressing commodities. Look what happened to copper this week. Look what happened to crude oil this week. Look where the ags are. The CRB is on the verge of a major breakdown. And if you do a ratio against the dollar is leading commodities lower. Okay, emerging market currencies have rolled over, and now emerging market stock indexes are cracking. So this, to me, is a big picture where you have inflation below the Fed's target. The Fed itself, if you look this week, you had three different speeches, Boston, Dallas, and St. Louis Fed presidents. All three mentioned the quote-unquote credibility of our inflation target. There's big questions marks out there, and there's a disinflationary to deflationary wave that the markets are telling us is coming that people just aren't getting with yet. And I think that that's a big deal. How we get from point A to point B and how we kind of bring the Fed back into play is the big question mark right now.
I think you're summing this up beautifully. I mean, strong U.S. dollar for everyone, weaker commodity prices because they're measured in U.S. dollars there. I think there's big trouble that comes for the emerging markets because they owe so much in U.S. dollar-denominated debt. You know, the list just goes on. I just think you've just nailed exactly what the issue is. I'm going to take a break in just a minute, Greg, and I want to So after the break, I'm asking you about gold. But just before, what you've just described, just to reiterate, you're not looking for an increase in interest rates then?
Absolutely not, Mike. I mean, it's a question of when do we get the Fed to turn to a bias towards ease? And, you know, when you talk about, and I'll make this real quick, when you talk about the emerging market currencies, we got to talk about that because there's a lot of places where they won't take the local currency anymore as a means of transactions. And that's a big problem.
Greg Weldon is my guest. You can find him at www.weldononline.com. You can see why he's the analyst other analysts read, because his global, his macro approach is so thorough. And it's exactly this. I hope you heard very clearly what he's saying the scenario is out there, because I think it's absolutely right on. We come back. I've got to ask Greg about gold. Is that the place to hide? We'll find out right here on the Money Talks Network. Greg Weldon, my guest right now. You're listening to Money Talks. I just want to reiterate what we were chatting about just before the break. And that is a higher U.S. dollar. Commodities, of course, measured in U.S. dollars. That puts them under pressure. Deflationary pressures around the world. Interest rates flat to looking for maybe even a decline. Yeah, the U.S. trade deal, if one gets produced, is going to produce a psychological boost. But as Greg mentions, and I think it's a great point, China would love to manipulate its own currency downward, making their exports more inexpensive so they can afford to give away a little bit more on the trade deal. All of that's coming to pass. I got two quick questions for Greg, maybe not so quick, but two questions for Greg I want to get to. One is, can you just give us a quick, you know, just a breeze over, flyby on the stocks?
Yeah, well, I mean, stocks are really kind of critical right here, because if you look at, in particularly in the U.S., but also in places like Canada, I mean, come on. I mean, the Canadian 10-year yield is you know, 5 basis points above the 2-year, and both of them are below the Bank of Canada's policy rate by, you know, 15 to 20 basis points. All right, in the U.S., you have a similar situation. 2-year, 5-year Treasury notes, both below the low end of the current Fed funds range. The Fed funds futures are anticipating 2, if not 3, rate cuts by the end of next year, and that the dollar's at new highs. So there's a disconnect in there. And I think, you know, getting the Fed from place A to place B, which is, okay, we're neutral. We think we've achieved, you know, kind of a neutral policy, and we have no bias towards, we have an easing bias because we see disinflationary waves emanating from the fact that the dollar's so strong. And if the dollar is so strong because you have a shortage of dollars at a time when dollar-denominated debt raised by other countries is massive and has exploded since 2008, that's a potential big problem. And that might manifest in the stock market if the Fed is not going to kind of validate the theme that the fixed income market is professing. So, again, it's kind of like, do you believe in the Easter Bunny? Well, the fixed income market sure does, but the foreign exchange market doesn't necessarily. Although a higher dollar could get the Fed into play, but I think it's going to take something more, and I think that may have to be, you know, a crack in the stock markets, and you know that would get the Fed's attention.
Well, let me just come to gold then, because, you know, when there's uncertainty, is it, you know, I guess everybody wants to know, when is it gold's turn? What are you looking for? What are the kind of indicators?
Well, you know, I was doing one of the pre-opening shows last week here in the U.S., and the host was like, you know, you've got gold between, you know, 1265 and 1365 for the last, you know, whatever it is, year and a half, 2 years. He goes, that's pretty poor performance. So everyone's disappointed with gold, right? And I said, I tell you what, given the dollar's up, you know, 10% against many currencies, at a record high against many currencies, and breaking out in the dollar index, the trade-weighted dollar is even already higher. The performance in gold is phenomenal, Mike. I mean, the fact that it hasn't cracked 1265 is testament to the breakdown in the normal relationships here. And I think this is a huge point that really has to be understood. And again, I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. And it's fairly simple. It's a growing global distrust and discomfort with all paper. IOUs, whether it's debt or sovereign debt, corporate debt, whatever, it's debt or it's currencies, which are simply an IOU as well. And when you have all this dollar debt and you have places like, I'll throw countries at you where the currencies are just getting mauled, Mike. I mean, Pakistan, Argentina, Turkey. Let's take a place like Angola. All right, it's like, who cares about Angola? Well, I care about Angola, and there's a big reason. First, it produces more oil than does Nigeria right now. It's an OPEC member. You can no longer use the local currency, which is the kwacha, locally to buy goods and services. That currency is down 460% in the last 5 years. This is a big problem. And what is the end result of this for gold? Gold in kwacha is at a record high. It's screaming because people are scrambling for dollars or metal. And when you start to think then more mainstream, okay, Switzerland, Australia, Sweden, these are places that have either, in the case of Australia, said they're telegraphing rate cuts, the central bank is. You had a housing bubble that just burst, i.e. something we can talk about in terms of Canada, and the real estate market there is coming unglued very quickly. And then you look at a place like Sweden with the deepest negative, you know, real policy rates. Where is gold? It's at record highs in Aussie dollars. It's at record highs in Swedish krona. So the time for gold is here. The question is, when does the dollar come into play? When does the Fed come into play? And that's going to be the big explosive move. And the fact that gold hasn't broken 1260, the fact that gold isn't actually trading 1100 or 1050 already, based on what the dollar is very positive relative performance and sets up well for the, you know, for the medium term to longer term future.
But an incredibly important point, because, I mean, if you're in Canada and you've got Canadian dollars, gold's within, I don't know, $100 of its all-time high. If you're in another country, you know, the euro gold's been doing very well. As the euro falls like a stone against the U.S. dollar, and I think there's a lot more of that to come. You know, can you imagine if you had gold in Venezuela? You've been in the most raging bull market in history. So it's very important to get the currency right, as Greg is saying here. And I couldn't agree more that, you know, when you look at some of the problems kind of emerging, gold is going to have its turn. You're doing something, by the way, I want you to explain it to me. You've been known for successful gold investing, gold trading, gold market analysis, that kind of stuff. So you've got the gold investors and the gold, you know, the gold market camp that you're coming up. You're doing a course. Sorry, excuse me, Greg. You're doing a course coming up. Tell me a little bit about that.
It's what we're calling it, the Gold Investor Bootcamp. And it is kind of plays off the book, of course, I wrote in 2006, Gold Trading Bootcamp, when we called the meltdown in the U.S. you know, subprime market. We said the Fed would monetize Treasury debt, something that was considered heresy at the time, and, you know, got me thrown off CNBC because I said the Fed's going to buy, you know, Treasury debt and work the dollar lower, and gold's going to triple in price. Well, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
The bigger picture here is even bigger than it was then. Gold is probably cheaper here at $1,300 than it was then at 4.25. And so what we want to do is help investors out there, to help your listeners in particular. You're kind of the prototype of listener who is, you know, kind of do-it-yourselfer, is a self-made man, is investing themselves. So the Gold Investor Bootcamp is going to give you everything you need to know about trading gold, investing in gold, or buying gold in physical form, whether it's bars or coins. Do we invest in the individual mining shares? Do we play the ETFs? Do we do a futures account? I'm going to cover all of this. It's massive. I'm just pouring everything into this. We're holding nothing back. And it's three. It's a kind of a lesson plan. There's four lessons. The first three are videos that I do myself, interactive with a textbook. It's over 200 pages, about 3 hours of stuff. I mean, we're going to cover everything. All right, macro, technical, you know, gold. I mean, the history of gold. What is gold really valued here, given all the paper out there? The numbers will blow you away, man. So, and then part four is a live interactive session with me where I will show you my screens. I will show you my risk metrics. I will show you everything that I do here, holding nothing back, and then take questions, you know, for as long as it takes to clear the deck. So I think, you know, we're trying to, you know, offer this at a really, really reasonable price, given, you know, what the value of this boot camp would be for anyone, whether it's someone looking to buy coins, looking to invest in mining shares, or someone looking to more actively trade the futures markets. Everyone's welcome, because there's something for everyone in this boot camp.
Well, this is the part that I didn't want to tell you right up front, though, because our people have been talking to your office about this. And I always love to get kind of a deal for Money Talks listeners. So, yes, it's offered at a great price. It's offered at $4.99, but Money Talks listeners, I wanted to say this just so you didn't hang up on me. Get $200 off that
price. People are going to get fired, Mike.
Yeah. Well, that's a heck of a deal. $299 US for this. As I say, it's a four-part course, including one lesson with you. Just go to moneytalks.net. Greg doesn't know about this, but Mike's moneytalks.ca or moneytalks.net. Get all the details with Greg Weldon. Mike's moneytalks.ca or moneytalks.net. If you are at all interested in gold over the next several years, I think this is just a great opportunity. Greg, time's short. I'll just say thanks so much as usual. We appreciate you taking the time with us.
My pleasure, Mike. As always, you do a great job, and hats off for the great success with the Special Olympics.
Thank you. We'll be back with our shocking stat of the week. Stay with us. Time now for the shocking stat of the week. This week's shocking stat deals with a monumental shift in society. You know, I'm constantly amazed at how determined our politicians are to not talk about the financial implications of an aging population. I mean, we're going to have a federal election, well, we're basically in that campaign right now. And it's a good bet that you're not going to find anybody talking about the incredible cost increases because of the aging population to things like old age security, escalating at over $3 billion extra every year, compounding. It's going to move to about $6 billion coming up shortly. I'm looking at some of the latest demographic stats. I was thinking, are we really going to be surprised when we get stories about crowded healthcare, emergency wards, or lack of beds, or funding problems? Come on. My guess, yes, it probably will be, despite the fact that the vast majority of us certainly know the population is aging. I mean, how couldn't you know? Gosh, think about it. If you're living in British Columbia right now, 30% of the population's over 65. And the retirement set's going to represent 50% of BC's population in the next 20 years. One of the stats that we've been telling you about for the last 3 years is that there are more people over the age of 65 than under 15 in Canada. That means growing demands on pensions, senior care, health care, and it's a drag on economic growth. I think that's why politicians hate demographics, because the math of an aging population trumps political ideology every time. It really tears apart their so-called costing of new spending promises. I think that's why they ignore it. Every party's done it. But it's not just Canada, and that brings me to my shocking stat of the week. It's happening all over the world. Our World in Data has just stated that for the first time in history, there are more people over the age of 64 than under the age of 5. The key to understand is that covers the whole world, because, see, higher income countries that have low fertility rates, like Canada and the U.S., well, seniors have outnumbered children under 5, well, decades ago, probably in the mid-60s. Countries like Nigeria, though, who have high fertility rates but shorter life expectancy, are still decades away from that. But for the entire world, there are now more seniors than children under 5, which clearly points to an aging population, and there are massive implications for that. I'll take a break. I've done something a little different with Ozzie Jurek this week, by the way. I said to him, you know, we always do, these recommendations, the hot properties for the week. I said, I wanted him to give us a couple and go through with us a bit, like, how does he determine which ones? He always, rightly so, we always say, I mean, this is up for you to do your due diligence. Does it fit for you or not? Just interesting things. But I said, Ozzie, let's take one or two of them and actually work through a little bit about what he would look for if he was doing further research on them. I'll take a break. I'll come back. Ozzie Jurek in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us. And just by the way, if you can help out with Special Olympics, send us an email to mark@mikesmoneytalks.ca. Send an email to mark@mikesmoneytalks.ca. That would be much appreciated. I hope you take the time to do it. And I forgot to tell you, I got a gift for you. Doesn't that sound nice? I got a gift for you. This is an idea I had a while back. I said, why don't we go and ask all of the people who participate with us to, I wanted to know what they're thinking for the second half of 2019. What kinds of stuff are coming our way that we should be aware of? And so what's kind of interesting is that we've got a huge raft of people who are participating in this, which I'm thrilled to say they are, by the way. Greg Weldon is one of them who has participated. So we've put together this, and it's absolutely free, by the way, but we've put together this piece, 13 different chapters, different analysts, Tyler Bullhorn, as I said, Greg Weldon. The list is a long one, but I forgot to tell you about this. All you have to do is go to moneytalks.net, have a look at that, and Yeah, you can just sign up and we'll get you access to the piece. I just think it's a great idea, something that we've been working on for a bit, trying to coordinate it all. And so take advantage of it. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. You'll see it right there. It's a free email service, and this is certainly free for everyone doing that. But it's really asking about what the opportunities and pitfalls are for the rest of 2019. Joseph Schachter's helped us out with that. Patrick Cerisna, Ozzy, has done that. Paul Beattie, Don Velo, John Johnston. I mean, so many great people. And we just wanted to give that to you, to give you an update on so many things that we've been talking about there and get their opinion too. I wanted to read it on investment opportunities and pitfalls for the rest of 2019. It's a special report, but it's free. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. Ozzy Jurek joins me on the line right now. Ozzy, by the way, thanks for your help with that. But you know what? All the times I get these questions about these hot properties, and we make it very clear, you have to go check them out. You have to look at them and see if this is right for you, your own financial circumstances. But I thought what was would be kind of fun, just to, if you can give me, you know, it's a kind of a buyer's market out there right now, but, you know, help me out. Give me a couple of examples and talk me through it.
Well, the thing is that we always celebrate the opposite market. You know, when somebody is $50,000 too much for a house and bids well over the price, then we're saying that's a good market. Well, today the buyer has the ideal market. If you want to have a home for your kids and your family, you can make offers. The property's on the market. The realtors have time. And so when we look for something that's special, that has to be then have some special features. Let's say if you're an investor, does the property cash flow with after I put 20% down? Or is the price reduced? Or is it offered at more than 15% below property assessment, for instance? We have a house in Langley right now that's $391,000 below tax assessment. I'm like, I don't know whether it's really great value, but that opened my eyes. I thought, my goodness, here you have a 3,600 square foot home on 23,000 square foot lot for $970,000. It's down. The government thinks it's worth less. So we call it a hot property. It doesn't mean I have seen it. I'm just saying I put it out there. We don't charge for it. We simply, somebody calls us on the hot property. They're here when you and I talk, or they go to our website and see it, and then we put them in touch with either the owner or the realtor directly. So here, when there's a Richmond house, 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom at $850,000 in this market, hey, just the area we like, a certain price we like, because, I mean, if lots are selling for $1 million, I want to see what that house is like. Probably it's an old small house, but the simple secrets are values go where people go. When we recommend Surrey, it's because 1,000 people a month go there, and if I then find something that is less priced than what seems to be the average around there, or where the owner will carry a mortgage, that's what then constitutes a hot property. But you'll always have to do the deal yourself. It's nothing to do with me. We don't pay for it.
No, of course.
Say,
yeah.
Hey, this looks better for us. You know?
But the things you would look at if you were a listener and advising people is have a look at the cash flow. You know, and does it cash flow positively with 25% down? You just said, you know, the inflow of people, you know, as you said, an example is Surrey, 1,000 people moving in a month there. You know, if the price reduced, you asked what reason is. I know you told me that years ago. You know, find out why. And as you say, maybe a little twinge is when you find something that's offered well below, you know, the property assessment. But those are all the things. All I'm saying is those are the things that people should be checking on their own.
Oh, 100%. But, you know, you and I have been talking, for instance, of office condos downtown, I guess, for 10 years. Well, you know, they've tripled in value, so you could have had your own little office somewhere. I mean, I'm in the Electra downtown, which are all little cubbyhole offices, but they tripled in value. Or right now, you might consider, you know, the overnight delivery. They need warehouses. They need warehouses in town, you know, so they can do the overnight. So there's some new opportunities that develop. Or movie studios are looking for space. So we talked about it at length at our Lancashire conference, that this is a new world, right? We'll have a four-day week. We'll have a cashless society. We have a paperless society. All of those kind of things are coming to us. You talk about it all the time. But in that new world, there's also always opportunity on the real estate side.
Well, one of the opportunities, I'll just be quick with this, is that we're starting to hear, and you told us this was coming, and it's been coming over the last 6 months. We've been hearing about it, but sort of little incentives and come-ons to be buyers. You know, we've come out of a market, for example, in Vancouver or Burnaby or where have you, and there's been, like, you know, as you say, they beat each other up just to make an offer. Now that's changed. You know, we're more similar in that kind of demand way to Calgary and Edmonton now. But, you know, you hear some of these incentive packages. I've been hearing one, which is great. If you're a wine drinker, get free wine. What are the things that you would like to see?
I mean, to me, it's a little silly. Get free wine, like a $1,500 thing, or go to the Millennials, avocado on toast. That's going to make me buy this condo. No. Make a real offer. I mean, you know, as I said, it's okay to overprice a unit. Well, instead of $50,000 more, offer $50,000 less. But ask for a furniture package, maybe for $10,000-$15,000. Ask for a car. I mean, okay, a small car, or maybe a car that paid the lease on for 5 years. But this is a buyer's market, and Mike, in life, you don't get what you deserve. You get what you negotiate. And so the market is slow. Sales are down. Go out there and make some offers, and you don't have to make stink bids, but make quality offers and be prepared to close, and you might just be surprised what kind of a deal you can get.
Well, we don't have time to go in this. Ozzy's just giving us an example of the kind of things you should ask. Go to his website, www.juruck.com, J-U-R-O-C-K.com. Just one more very quick, Ozzy. One of the things that just reminds me that you've told me, again, years ago, don't buy a house if yours hasn't sold.
Oh, Mike, that is so important. You know, so often we think, oh, our house will sell. Maybe my friend says, oh, you have no problem selling your house. And then it doesn't, but you're stuck buying the one you bought. Make it either subject to the sale of selling your house or don't buy it. Wait till yours is sold. This is not the market to fool around and then carry two mortgages maybe for a year or longer.
One last one. Give us one more. I'm thinking on Greater Victoria, the Victoria area. You got a hot property for us?
Yeah, I think the least expensive acreage there, a 5-bedroom, 4-bathroom, 3,000 square feet, 1,200 square foot workshop, self-contained cottage of 800 square feet on 2.5 acres, and that's on at $969,000. That is the cheapest acreage with a suite in Victoria.
A great example. Now go do your homework. Listen to what Ozzy says. Do your homework and find out. Ozzy, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Mike. And I just want to leave you with this thought. I hate it when I think I'm buying organic vegetables, and then when I get home, I discover they're just regular donuts.
And by the way, my thanks to Ozzy Juruck. He'll be playing at the Special Olympics tournament June 20th. Always a big supporter, and it's going to be great. That's a warning as well as a thank you. Warning, Ozzy Juruck will be playing. I'll take a break. I'll come back. Looking forward to Victor Adair live from the trading desk, and I got a good goofy. Stay with us. Let's go live to the trading desk. This is Money for Something Global. We've got Victor Adair joins me. Victor, interesting to hear what I found Greg Weldon had to say, especially in light of this week where I saw markets kind of a little skittish out there.
Yeah, I started my blog this week by saying that the global financial markets were driven more by fear than by greed this week. But there really wasn't any panic in the market, unless maybe you look at the crude oil market, which tumbled about 13% in 3 days. But like over in the stock market, the currency markets, the treasury markets, you know, it wasn't like there was panic. There was definitely things moving around and a few key things, not the least of which was this very sharp tumble in WTI. But the currency markets, now you've already discussed this, but, you know, there are these elections going on in Europe. For the European Parliament, there's, I think, 500 million people are eligible to cast votes from 28 different countries for 750 seats in the parliament. What I'm seeing this election as is a possible litmus test to see just how popular the populists are. So the way this might play out is if the populist crowd, you know, the anti-establishment crowd that's been popping up here and there around Europe, gets more votes than expected, that's probably going to mean the euro currency falls. On the other hand, the market's been kind of bracing itself for that. And if, in fact, the populists aren't all that popular, the euro, which has been kind of driven to two-year lows here as of this past week, might have a pop. So, you know, that's the kind of things that I look for, is sort of like if the market's positioned one way and then maybe the unexpected happens, you know, then you'll get a reversal in prices. Hello, Mike? Oh, maybe.
Yeah, there you go. Hi, sorry, Victor. It's my fault. What are you doing in the market with that kind of context?
What I was doing, I came into the market this past week. I was short of gold, and I was short of the Japanese yen. I took profits on both of those positions early in the week. Gold had traded down from the mid-month highs, traded down about $40, broke through a support level around 1270, but couldn't sustain the break. And I don't like being short. The market's not going down, so I got out. And I did a 180. By the end of the week, I bought what I call a toe-in-the-water size position in a basket of currencies, the Australian dollar, the which has just been absolutely clobbered the past couple of months, the Japanese yen, the Swiss franc, and the euro. Now, I'm looking for these currencies, which have been in a downtrend, to have a bounce, because I think they're very oversold here. This is a short-term trade. I know it goes kind of counter to what Greg's talking about, but Greg's talking about a much longer time frame than I am. And if I'm wrong on those trades, you know, I've got tight stops, I'll be out quickly.
Well, as I say, you know, the European election is going to hold a real key watching it. Can you give me 30 seconds on the Canadian dollar?
Canadian dollar has been dull as dishwater. I mean, a couple of the things that affect the Canadian dollar, certainly the up or down of the big dollar, the U.S. dollar, is very important. Interest rate spreads have actually been moving in Canada's favor, although America still pays more interest. And then, of course, this week we had crude oil take a tumble. So there's been pluses and minuses in the Canadian dollar. It has been trapped, really, in a half-cent trading range for a little better than a month. I just don't see any reason now to take a position, unless if the U.S. dollar is to take a little bit of a fall. Speculators have been heavily short the Canadian dollar. We could see Canada pop if those speculators have to start to cover their positions.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it, and I wanted to remind people, go to polarfuturesgroup.com, and Victor does a great job of outlining what's been happening in the markets, what he anticipates with the charts. It's everything. Obviously, we don't do charts on the radio, so go to polarfuturesgroup.com. Vic, go out and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Time now for this week's Goofy. Remember when the Canadian government announced $600 million in media subsidies? I mean, I, like many others, question the independence of any media outlet on the receiving end. But it doesn't seem like that's enough. I mean, at the very least, how can the media on the receiving end question with any credibility subsidies to other well-connected groups, maybe the auto industry, aerospace, companies like Bombardier? I mean, for years, many in the media decried big money influence from unions and corporations and politics. How is accepting tens of millions of dollars from government any different? I mean, it's incredible that the government interference comes at a time when the media's credibility is being so aggressively questioned. I just find it flabbergasting. Now, to their credit, by the way, many commentators in the media have weighed in with their concern, some with their disgust. But this week's announcement as to who's going to decide which media outlets gets the money, I think has outdone even the most cynical. I mean, when the plan was first announced, I remember the National Post Andrew Coyne wrote, "I don't actually think the government will appoint a group of card-carrying liberal hacks to the independent panel that decides who gets the money." Well, he was wrong. This week we found out there are 8 groups, of course, all in favor of the Liberal plan. But they've also chosen, I mean, this is what I think blew people away, and I think it illustrates the depth of the cynicism of the federal Liberals, is the choice of Unifor, the largest private sector union who is currently running an anti-conservative party campaign. They're going to choose which media outlets. Unifor, under Jerry Diaz, is arguably the most partisan, biggest money political group in the country. They have actively, openly been campaigning against the conservatives. I mean, in November, they unveiled their resistance campaign with the words right across it, Andrew Scheer's worst nightmare. How can they suggest that this is going to be sort of an independent panel? I know, when questioned, the Liberals and Unifor offered up some drivel about, you know, democracy needs a free and independent press. Well, as if anointing a highly partisan union to help decide who gets a piece of $600 million tax dollars is part and parcel of a free and independent press. I mean, it's brazenly, brazenly cynical. I'll leave the last word to Andrew Coyne, who summed it up by saying, "This is the most serious threat to the independence of the press in this country in decades." My thanks to you for listening. My thanks to Greg Schott for all the work on the technical side. And I'll talk to you next week.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.